All right, so we've finally gotten to the second verse in Genesis 1. And it describes the initial conditions of planet Earth before God began to give it form and fill it with life. So today, we'll look at each of these initial conditions and events described in this verse to see how they match up with the evidence from nature that modern scientists can either detect or infer. This verse raises a number of questions that we want to answer. First, does it accurately describe primordial Earth? And if so, how early in Earth's history do these conditions exist? So what are we looking at here? Then there are the issues that puzzle theologians. Verse 1 used the verb bara for create, which is used for something that's only done by God and usually ends up with perfection. Then immediately in verse 2, we see massive imperfection. It's a picture of how God... If it's a picture of how God formed the earth, it's like watching sausage being made. There's chaos, formlessness, lifelessness. Either God formed the earth in stages, and the early stages were very chaotic, or something happened between verses 1 and 2 to desolate primordial earth and leave it in this chaotic shape. So, what are the arguments for or against this? And there's a possible scientific explanation for this that we'll look at today. Today's going to be a lot of science because we're looking at nature and is there evidence for this. And so we'll look at a possible scientific explanation for this today. And the imagery used of darkness, death, and chaos is usually associated with God's judgment. And a number of theologians have struggled with this picture because it's not the beautiful creation we'd expect God to bring into existence. So we'll also look at a possible spiritual explanation for the chaos and this picture of judgment that we see in this verse. So we've got a lot to cover today in just these two sentences of this one verse. So let's begin with the first question I posed earlier. Does this verse accurately describe primordial Earth? And if so, how early in Earth's history does it begin? As we saw last week in Genesis 1-2, there are seven key revelations that tell us the condition of primordial Earth when Moses begins his creation account. They're on your handout, and we'll take them one at a time. So the first, the Earth's surface was without any geographic formation. That's the first thing we're told. The initial condition of Earth is totally unformed. In other words, the surface of the Earth had no geographic structure or form we would recognize. And this is really difficult to imagine when we see so much geographic variety today. The Hebrew word translated without form here is tohu. And it has an even deeper meaning than the English translation, indicating a desolate, hostile wasteland in a chaotic state and unfit for life. So what the earth was like when it was formless and chaotic is somewhat of a mystery that we'll attempt to unravel with the information given here in this verse and as we go through the action God takes to bring form and order to the earth. To make it an acceptable home for mankind. Our difficulty in unraveling the mystery is not just biblical. This description appears to fit the earth very early in its history and at a time that's difficult for science to unravel. There's just not a lot of evidence. They must speculate on the evidence available. As a researcher of this time period from the Australian National University said, the history of the earth is like a book with its first chapter ripped out with no surviving rocks from the very early period. So, yeah, we've got to struggle with the unknowns here. And it's, again, what we talked about last week, this struggle between the truth and the whole truth. And that's through the Bible. It's also, you know, looking at nature and the record of nature. A question I posed last week is, did Moses just begin his account at a time of chaos, darkness, and an abyss, a watery abyss, because that's where the accounts of the cultures around early Israel began theirs? Or was there a time when the earth was without form? The conditions described here actually seem reasonable from the scientific literature, and I'm going to go through a lot of that today. And this is from people who are not trying to prove that the Bible is true. If it's true, it fits the scientific literature, if you imagine Earth is very new, newer than maybe I assumed it was when I first read it. Several recent scientific papers discuss that the primordial Earth was covered in a global ocean, although much shallower today, and had little or no land above the water, so no form. Some scientists have analyzed the tiny zircon mineral grains contained in the oldest rocks ever found and have used this to build a profile of the world at that time. Quoting from a paper year before last, the scientist said, "Our research indicates there were no mountains or continental collisions during Earth's first 700 million years or more of its existence. It was a much more quiet and dull place." These conditions predated, they say, the late heavy bombardment of 4.1 to 3.8 billion years ago when comets and asteroids pummeled the Earth. So this even is before that late heavy bombardment that you may have heard about. Scientists believe the Earth is a little over 4.5 billion years old. So somewhere between 4.3.8, 4.1, and 4.5 billion is when they say this condition existed. They go on to say that when the Earth was hot and the mantle was soft, continents and mountains could not be supported. So that's why there's no form. When the mantle cooled, it was able to support large swaths of land above sea level. This paper also said that the crust must be thick for land to stick out of water. The thickness depends on its amount and also the thermal regulation and the viscosity of the mantle. So the Earth could be described as not having any geographic form if it's earlier than this 4.1 to 3.8 billion years ago. All right, the second thing we want to look at is the state of the Earth, completely empty. It was described not only as formless but also void. The word translated void means completely empty and lifeless. Just nothing there. The two words of Hebrew sound poetic, tohu and abohu. Together they mean chaotic and empty. From all appearances, Earth is a very unlikely place to ever contain life. As we saw a few weeks ago, these two words, without form and void, are a pattern for how God will bring structure, order, and life to the Earth to achieve his goal of creating man in his image. So on days 1, 2, and 3, God brings form to the primordial earth. We have light, water cycle, dry land, plants, and atmosphere being formed the first 3 days. Then in days 4, 5, and 6, God makes the earth no longer void by creating inhabitants for the sky, water, and land. So the account shows Moses' initial audience as well as modern readers that God is a God who brings life out of lifelessness. The earth described in this verse, however, is not only lifeless, it is hostile to life. This seems to fit very early earth. Now, the third factor is a little more difficult to verify. The earth's surface is totally dark. In fact, it's pitch black. There's absolutely no light on the surface. So what might explain this fact? The earlier book of Job, in one of its chapters about creation, had already stated that at one point in Earth's formation, God had wrapped it in thick darkness, like a baby is swaddled in a thick blanket. You can see that on your handout, Job 38:9. One way the authors of the Bible have reached mankind through the centuries is through the use of word pictures. The book of Job uses poetic word picture language, comparing the thick darkness of the earth being wrapped in thick clouds like a garment to reveal basic information about why the earth is totally dark that we don't see in Genesis 1-2. As I said, first week, there's no creation account that gives you all the information. You kind of have to look at all the related verses and piece things together. God, it's that way because God clothed it in clouds of darkness. Its totally dark condition is not accidental and apparently not original. This is not a description of the darkness from dark, heavy clouds that we would experience today, but rather some dense, debris-like substance that was so opaque that no light could penetrate to Earth's surface. So it'd be impossible to tell day from night. Like going into a cave at Blanchard Springs and having the lights turned off. If you've ever experienced that, you can't see your hand here. The verse in Job seems to say that God took some action before Genesis 1-2 to cover the earth with opaque clouds. The language in Genesis 1-2 is interesting when you compare it to Job. Some have translated the phrase "was without form" in Genesis 1-2 as "became without form." This implies that the earth had existed in another state and was somehow changed to the condition we see in Genesis 1-2. Although the word there can mean "became," most translators don't believe that's indicated here. Rather, it's just describing a stage in Earth's history. So the question I posed earlier, was the Earth totally dark? And if so, what stage in Earth's early history would fit these descriptions? And how in the world would scientists determine darkness in the geographical record? I mean, there, you know, nothing there that would indicate darkness. So let me digress for a moment here back to a question last week about whether I believed the universe appears random and as if it could have happened by chance. And I answered that question by saying no, and I referenced the fine-tuning of the universe's expansion rate as not being consistent with chance and randomness. It requires intelligence and care to have that extreme level of fine-tuning. There are also a great many things that make Earth uniquely suited for advanced life, and the number of these things make it difficult for me to believe that they occurred by chance. And so I'll tell them to you, and you can see what you think. First, a planet the size of Earth should have a thick, life-suffocating atmosphere similar to what we see on Venus. So the rule of thumb is the greater a planet's surface gravity and distance from its star, the heavier and thicker its atmosphere. So theoretically, our atmosphere should be thicker and heavier than Venus. In fact, we have one about 40 times lighter and thinner. We have an atmosphere thin enough for light to pass through. Second, the Earth is richer in heavy metals and radioactive elements than scientists can explain by just its formation. Something has raised the amount of iron, for example, in the Earth's core to a level where the Earth can have a strong and enduring magnetic field to shield life from deadly cosmic rays and provide iron for life in the seas, which supports land life. And the core of the Earth has enough heavy metals in the right quantities to produce long-lasting continent-building plate tectonics, which help compensate for the sun's increasing brightness over time and bring new minerals up from under the ground. An abundance of long-lasting radioisotopes provide the heat that drives most of Earth's tectonic activity and volcanism. So, and something has gradually slowed the Earth's fast rotation rate to allow advanced light. It should be spinning faster. And something stabilized the tilt of the Earth's axis, protecting the planet from rapid and extreme climatic variations. So Earth is a Goldilocks planet, and it shouldn't be. Right? It shouldn't be. I mean, now, its current state, you know, isn't natural, and it is mysterious. It appears that most of the unique features I just went over of Earth are changes that came about because of the creation of Earth's moon. We have a massive moon compared to the size of our planet, and it stabilizes the tilt of the Earth's axis and slowed the rotation. Now, forgive me if you've kind of heard how people think the moon was formed, and it's a relatively new insight. When Americans landed men on the moon, what NASA discovered about the moon rocks they brought back helped to form a generally accepted hypothesis about how the moon was formed. Like almost everything in science, it's currently being tested and may change somewhat someday, but the scientific explanation goes something like this. Most moons in our solar system form out of the same material that generates the planets. They're relatively small compared to their planets, and in the outer planets are foreign bodies that have been captured by that planet's gravity. The inner planets don't have moons. Some moons aren't even round, kind of lumpy. The Earth's moon orbits a planet close to the sun and is huge compared to the planet. The moon is younger than the Earth, according to the Apollo lunar rock samples. They're 4.25 billion years old, compared to Earth's 4.57 billion years. The moon's crust is chemically distinct from the Earth because they're lighter. The moon rocks are lighter than Earth rocks, but not as distinct as Mars is from Earth, for example. There are many similarities, and the moon is slowly moving away from the Earth, almost imperceptibly, year by year. And the calculations indicate that the moon was in contact or near contact with Earth a little over 4.25 billion years ago, the same age as the rocks. In contrast, one moon of Mars is moving closer to the planet because of gravity. Our moon is moving away. So you have to have an explanation for that. So really only one explanation fits all the observed parameters. A body at least the size of Mars, and possibly twice as large, made a nearly head-on hit with the Earth and was absorbed, for the most part, into Earth's core, leaving all the heavy stuff in the Earth. Such a collision would have blasted almost all of Earth's heavy, thick, original atmosphere into outer space. So it thinned our atmosphere. The shell or cloud of debris arising from the collision would orbit Earth and eventually coalesce to form our moon. So this collision would have resulted in a very chaotic state and most probably was the initial first step in this Goldilocks planet we see today. So with respect to our text, this debris cloud would have totally enclosed the Earth for a period of time. It would have left the Earth formless and void, and a completely dark place. It's not clouds, it's debris. Although it would kind of look like clouds, word picture. But the collision helped transform it into a place where life could thrive because of all those fine-tuning things about the Earth that I went over. There's remarkable fine-tuning needed for this single event. Just the right size collider, at just the right speed and angle. We would not expect to find even one planet by natural processes alone that would end up with all of the factors needed to support life. So really we're looking at a miracle every time we see the moon. So the collision event would create total darkness, and from the age of the moon, which would have formed afterward from the debris cloud, this condition of Earth would have existed between 4.25 and 4.57 billion years ago, so even earlier in Earth's history. 250 million years old or less, right? So on geographic time, that's early. It doesn't seem early to us. So science would indicate that the early Earth, initial Earth, was devastated and had to reform after the collision. There may be another explanation for this initial condition described by Moses. For example, every early planet that's been discovered is surrounded by a debris cloud, just in the way the planet is formed. But still would leave darkness. But current scientific thought does fit the biblical description. So this totally dark condition would have existed in primordial Earth. So any questions, thoughts on that before I go on? I know it's like a fire hose.
There's this moon theory in the darkness. The debris and all that? Is that a fairly widely accepted thing, or is that a new thing?
The moon thing is fairly widely accepted. I Googled to see if there's any recent research, and there were like 8 or 9 scientific groups testing this theory. I mean, there are every year. Einstein's theory of relativity is so tested, I would think it'd be a law, and they're still testing that every year. So they'll still test it. All of them but one agreed with this, and one said, we're not sure because there's a little bit of difference in something. I don't remember what kind of rock. But so, you know, they'll test it forever. But it's pretty generally accepted, yeah. If you watch TV shows, they'll talk about this. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. Okay, so last month when we were looking at the creation of the universe, and I said, what was God doing before he created the universe? We saw a verse that said Jesus planned our redemption before God even began to create the universe. So God was a redeemer before the creation of the universe. So God's always been both creator and redeemer. So here in this verse, we see the first act of creation, and in the rest of the chapter, is really redemptive. And that's before Genesis 3:15, which promises a future redeemer, kind of the first prophecy about Jesus. God's first act is redeeming the earth itself. So we start with a situation that needs redemption, chaos, darkness, and confusion. And as we talked about a little last week, it becomes throughout Scripture really a perfect model of God's redeeming work in our lives. We're in need of redemption. We're in darkness spiritually before we're born again. Our lives are chaotic, and God saves us and puts us into a cosmos with light and order when we're under his creative control. So Genesis 1 is an analogy to our redemption, telling us God is a redeemer. And the point of the passage spiritually is he ended up with a perfect condition for his plan. The end of Isaiah 45 tells us that God's whole historical program, with God's historical program, God's not going to end up with a mess. You know, he's going to bring it to perfection. And you can trust that what this God has begun, he'll finish. It won't end up with destruction of the church. It will end up with the triumph of Jesus Christ. He will make us perfect. This is the intention of this passage. The earth was all messed up, just as our lives were all messed up, just as ancient Israel's life seemed in the wilderness. But what does this tell us about God? God will redeem our lives as he redeemed the earth. All right, the fourth thing to notice about this passage is Earth is a water world. It's totally covered in ocean. We saw that in a couple of scientific references earlier to when there was no form. So land was not visible above the water's surface. The parallel, Psalm 104 and Genesis 1 are the two chronological creation accounts. The others aren't chronological. And so they're parallel passages. And Psalm 104, verses 5 and 6, echoes this description of a water world, as does David in Psalm 24 and Peter in 2 Peter 3. Psalm 104 may show that the earth was not initially created as a water world sometime before this verse. So God took action to cover it in water like a garment, so it would be formed out of water and by water, as Peter said. I don't know how we got to be a water world. I can't really describe that. But lots of verses in the Bible say that's our initial condition, and that's verified by science. A study by the University of California, Davis, published in 2002, found that the continents emerged relatively suddenly from an ocean that covered at least 95% of the Earth's surface, which is what the Bible describes as happening on day three. When land abruptly comes up above the water. The study from Australia I mentioned earlier also found that the earth was covered in water by studying zircon and found that sediments from continents did not occur during this early stage in Earth's history. The oceans, as said, would have been much shallower and the water, therefore, would have spread much further. Today it covers 70% of the planet with land displacing part of it. In 2008, a study of the University of Oregon analyzed the chemical signatures of shale, which is Earth's most common sedimentary rock. In a study published in Nature, the lead scientist said that the emergence of land out of a world covered in water happened abruptly in parallel with large-scale changes in mantle dynamics. So as the mantle changed, we were able to have some form and land appear above the water. Again, the Bible describes this abrupt appearance of land on day three out of a water world. So quite a few studies confirm this initial feature of Earth. All right, now if 5, 6, and 7 are more events than the initial condition of planet Earth. Number 5, and perhaps the most interesting part of Genesis 1-2, is the second sentence showing that the Spirit of God is hovering over the pitch-black, lifeless water world. So God, who exists outside the universe, comes into the universe he created to prepare the earth as the location for his plan to play out. This is kind of the opposite of eruption, right? Eruption from outside in. So God erupts into a given darkness and abyss to transform it into a good creation that produces and sustains life. Now, last week we went over the tool about viewpoint, as if you were a cameraman filming the action, where would you be pointing your camera? And we observed that the vantage point or viewpoint of the author and his audience in all those verses we looked at about the creation of the universe was somebody either outside the universe in heaven with God and the angels, or from outer space looking down on the earth. And we last week we discussed the point of view of the author in this verse. And my position is the author seems to signal that the point of view has changed in the third sentence of Genesis 1 with the Spirit of God now operating on the surface of the earth, hovering over the water's surface. And as we said, that the earth is now the focus is emphasized by mentioning earth at the first and end of the first two sentences. That's a real strong form of repetition. Throughout the rest of this chronological account, we're not given any indication that our viewpoint changes from the surface of the earth until Genesis 2:8, when Moses hones in on one area of the earth, the Garden of Eden. So we go from heaven, outer space, surface of the earth, Garden of Eden in viewpoint changes. Now, if the author was instead looking down on the earth from outer space or heaven, there would be no way to see what the earth's surface looked like or what was happening on the surface because of that thick blanket of dark clouds surrounding the earth. So it seems to me that the Bible is careful to tell us the point of view of the author, and we need to be careful to remember that point of view as we interpret the information we're seeing going forward. That's my perspective. Not everybody seems to even notice this viewpoint change. They don't disagree with it. They just either mention it or they don't. So he'll have to decide how you feel as we go through and look at the passage. All right, now number 7, at this time in Earth's history, God began some action requiring great care and tending. So the Spirit of God is acting somehow on the surface of the earth. The word translated as hovering indicates some purposeful, continuing, protective movement by the Spirit of God. So what is the Spirit tending here that would merit the use of this word? I don't know. The passage doesn't tell us. I wish I did. Whatever is happening, the Spirit began working in this extremely harsh, early environment. A clue to his activity is in the word translated hovering, which is a Hebrew word, rachaph, R-A-C-H-A-P-H, which means to hover, move, or flutter. It's only used twice in the Bible. The only other time this verb is used is in a passage poetically describing God's protective activity in the desert over the descendants of Jacob as he was forming them into a nation. And you'll see those two verses in Deuteronomy 32, 10 and 11 here. Notice the care God takes for his people in verse 10. The verbs are encircled, instructed, and kept. It really shows a very loving and very active God. Verse 10 and 11 are two descriptions of the same event. And usually in Hebrew poetry, two verses are paired. And in this case, the second verse says the same thing in a different way for emphasis. So in verse 11, God's activity over the tribes in the desert is similar to a poetic word picture of an eagle hovering, that verb again, over its young, teaching them to fly. So the image here is not a bird sitting on its eggs and patiently waiting for them to hatch. Rather, the eagle stirs up its nest, moves over its young eaglets, encouraging, instructing them on how to fly out of the nest. The phrase, carrying them on its wings, poetically shows God's powerful yet tender care for them. You know, in the long Exodus account, God superintended events and responses to events that helped form these people into a nation that he could use for his purpose. Now, notice the parallels between the two passages where the word hovering is used. Both Genesis 1 and Deuteronomy 32 take place in a wasteland. In Genesis 1:2, the Spirit is performing an activity over the primordial earth, like he did over the Hebrew tribes in the desert. Notice that this picture of the Spirit of God hovering over the earth and hovering over God's people opens and closes the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, like bookends. And again, repetition of the word has meaning for us. So God's care and tending at creation and God's care for his people begin and ends Moses' story to Israel. The first use here in Genesis 1:2 seems to describe to me something similar to how our modern-day scientists carefully craft experiments, control events, and fine-tune conditions. Might also be a picture of a mother preparing a nursery for an expected newborn. Whatever God is doing that is here described as hovering over the early hostile earth requires a lot of careful tending of conditions and direct intervention on his part. So the formation of the earth did not just happen by chance. So that's all the sciencey take on whether the conditions of verse 2 existed, and I'm going to turn to the implications of the chaotic conditions. But let me just stop and see if anybody has any questions or thoughts on all that to this point. Yeah, I know. It's a lot. I told you, this verse is just kind of chock full of stuff, and it's easy to just blow by it, right? Because it's so short. All right, so now I want to turn to the implications of the chaotic conditions in verse... Yes?
Sorry, I was thinking through a question.
Sure.
So the scientific theory then that the earth existed for a while before this darkness came above it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Would that, like in my mind, I guess I'm trying to think, like one question that I've always had about Genesis 1 and has always led me to look at it more as a literary narrative than as a factual narrative.
Yep.
Is the idea of, like, how do you even measure a day and a night without a sun?
Right. I mean, that's typical. Know? Right. I mean, you can't measure day and night without a sun. Right.
But if, like, you're talking about, like, what exists on the surface of the earth versus what exists in the universe. So the earth is still rotating around the sun in that idea.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it is still a day and a night. You know, and it was evening and then it was morning.
Mm-hmm.
That actually could mean that this happened in some.
Well, it could. I don't get too concerned about the length of time because obviously before day one, a whole lot of time, unknown time has passed,
yeah.
Right? Universe is created, blah, blah, blah. It doesn't even tell us how the earth was created in Genesis. That's why we went to all those other verses. I do think Genesis 1 is primarily a literary account. It's not a scientific account. It doesn't use scientific language. But my point really to today and as we go through is it true?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's great for me, for Moses, to start it where everybody else starts it, as long as he wasn't making it up.
Right.
You know? So that's why I'm really going through all this is, does it accurately describe the conditions? And so that's why I went through all this stuff is I think, yeah, it really does. Now, on the darkness of the earth, it could have been when earth was brand new.
Yeah.
It could have been because of this impact event,
yeah.
250, you know, well, probably not 250 million years, probably a little earlier than that. But either way, it's reasonable to think that an early planet would have been covered in dark debris cloud.
Sure.
And certainly, if the moon really was formed this way, that would be an even bigger debris cloud,
yeah.
Right? So that's my point in going through it. And also just to point out how, you know, carefully crafted the earth is. So to me, it does kind of look like we're told that God's making sausage. You know?
Yeah.
And then how bad it was, and then what a wonderful thing we end up with. But yeah, that's my take on it. So
yeah.
If the point of view
is
both in literary and factual, so but the point of view is important on how you determine particularly the first 4 days.
Yeah.
Because if you're looking at, if you have a totally dark earth and you're looking at it from outer space, as I said, you couldn't see what was on the surface, but you know, do you have any light out there or not? So in day one, when there's light, is that because God thins the debris?
Yeah.
Or is that because God creates light there?
Yeah.
When we, and the same with day four. It says God gave the moon and sun a role and a purpose. People look at that and think of material creation.
Yeah.
Is that when it was created? Well, if you're looking at it from the surface of the earth,
yeah. Sure.
First time you can see it, makes a big difference. And people look at it, interpret it both ways.
Yeah.
I went through all of those things about God creating the universe and all of that at first, because it's what a whole lot of the creation accounts talk about. Genesis doesn't. Genesis focuses on the earth.
Yeah.
And so that's, you know, we just have to grapple. We just have to grapple with that. And again, it's that tension between the truth and the whole truth. We're told the truth, but not everything we want to know.
Yeah.
But it's confusing.
Sure.
But I do think it's literary, but I also think it's accurate.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
And Jeff,
yes.
It's like, in my mind, I'm trying to wrap my mind around some of this. God could have just said, boom.
Exactly.
And everything was perfect. He chose to make it a process.
Yes. And why?
And why?
Yeah.
And he chose it just like he chose redemption of us to be a process.
Yeah.
It wasn't just boom, you know.
Right.
It was a process through the history of all these prefiguring of Christ and then Christ, and he does the same thing in our lives with sanctification. He didn't make us perfect.
It's a process.
It's a process.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
For some reason, God chooses that.
Yeah, and even if you take the one, you know, there, as I said, there are, I guess, three, maybe four literal definitions of the word day. Even if you take the word day to mean 24 hours, that's still not instant. God took his time. Why? You know, how much time he took. But when I read these passages, the authors just don't seem as concerned about when. I think that's a modern scientific curiosity thing. They're more interested in telling us about God. And what does this passage tell us about God? Okay, so that's the scientific take. If you need to leave, I'm going to run a couple of minutes over because we started a couple of minutes late, because I want to get to the possible spiritual take on it. The part where God's creation that's described as good later and yet it's chaotic in the first, and the difference between verse 1 and verse 2. So what does this chaos tell us about God and our relationship to him? You know, chaos is hostile to human life as we know it. We couldn't live in unlimited chaos. We still live with some chaos, like hurricanes and societal upheaval and so forth. Wherever we go, there's actually a little chaos. And the reason we're here is God sustains life in the midst of chaos and contains the chaos. So next week when we look at verse 3, he separates light and darkness. There's still some darkness, right? And when God removes his protection, chaos takes over. And the chaos doesn't explain the connection between God and chaos, but really, it really interprets the significance of creation. Israel's God overcomes the chaos to bring about his good pleasure, just as he'll overcome Israel, the chaos in Israel's future and in ours. So I think I'm going to stop and we'll pick up with the possible spiritual implications for the conditions we see in 1-2. People see imagery in 1-2 that's later associated with judgment, you know, death, chaos, and darkness. And so We'll go over that very quickly, talk about evil, because these things are also associated with evil. We've had some questions about evil here. And then we'll move on to verse 3 next week. Any thoughts or final thoughts or questions? All right. Thank y'all.
Thank you.